Okay, let's start. Here we go. The Senate State and Local Government Committee will come to order. Today is Wednesday, March 26, 2014. The first bill on the agenda, two bills, Senate File 2608, Senator Saxhog. This shit's turned off.
Interesting. Yeah. Oh, no. Shoot.
No, I didn't remember.
Two bills.
All right, we'll do these fast. Senator Saxhog, these are going to be quick, right? Because I told Senator Steven she could go first and forgot. So we'll go quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Today I'm presenting, as you stated, Senate File 2608. This bill repeals a 1986 authorization to create the Grand Rapids Central School Commission. This bill fits in nicely with Governor Dayton's desire to repeal outdated and unnecessary legislation during the unsession. With me today is Tom Pagel, Grand Rapids City Administrator, to explain the bill and answer any questions.
And this is Mr. Pagel. Any comments you'd like to make?
Madam Chair, none at this time. Other than it's...
Why don't you need this commission anymore?
We question why the commission was originally established. They have no taxing authority, no bonding authority, and we've turned over management of Central School to our Economic Development Authority.
All right. Is there a motion? Senator Wicklin moves that Senate File 2608. Before we take that motion, is there anyone in the audience that wants to testify? Are there any questions from members of the committee? Okay, then all in favor of the Wicklin motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. It goes to the floor. Senator Saxhog, your other bill is going to be as quick as this one?
It is. Well, I would hope so. You get a good question like you asked and a good answer like Mr. Pagel gave would be fine. Today, the Senate File 2609, this bill authorized the City of Grand Rapids to adopt an ordinance providing for four-year terms for members of the Public Utilities Commission. With me today is Tom Pagel, as we said before, the Grand Rapids City Administrator, to explain the bill and help answer any questions.
Okay, and Mr. Pagel, what's the reason for this change?
Madam Chair, we have special legislation to go to a five-member board, but we never addressed the terms of a five-member board, so currently our commissioners have three-year terms. What ends up happening is every couple of years we end up having two commissioners and sometimes a council member who end up going off of the board, and what we end up losing is a lot of institutional knowledge. It takes some time to rebuild that knowledge, and it would be nice if we only had the ability to lose one per year of those four appointed commissioners.
So sometimes we do this in law, but you're going to do it by ordinance, so kind of the first, will be staggered. You'll figure out a method to stagger them.
Correct.
Any questions from anybody on the committee? Anyone in the audience want to testify? Senator Wicklin then moves that Senate File 2609 be recommended to pass, and it does also goes to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Steven.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wicklin, members.
Oh, these are the LCPs. CPFFP.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for accommodating me. I have another bill up in Commerce shortly, too. So, members, Senate File 20.
Senator Stephen, Commerce isn't meeting, so hopefully you have a bill
jobs,
up somewhere else.
I meant.
Oh, jobs.
Senator Sparks.
Oh, yeah, me too. We're all in jobs today. Senator Stephen.
Madam Chair and members, Senate File 2699 is a bill that would increase the adjustment for the money that domiciliary residents are given. As members know, we have two domiciliaries that house our veterans in the state of Minnesota, one in Hastings and one in Minneapolis. And this bill would provide for an increase in the very limited money that residents receive from the state. And I do have an amendment that I would ask the committee to move. This is the first stop that this bill has been heard. and the language in the amendment would reflect some changes that have been made in the House, and that I can explain why we think it's a good idea.
Senator Wicklund moves to A1. Senator Scalzi moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevailed. That was the author's amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So again, the bill that's before you would increase the amount of money that domiciliary residents are provided with. The amendment would establish that the amount of money would amount to about 80 cents additional per day that residents are provided for the year of 2015. And the department's here, and they're supportive of the bill and the changes that are made, and they can help explain why we're proposing to make the change. So essentially, just to back up a minute, the language in the A1 amendment deleted the ongoing. There was language that would allow for this personal needs allowance to continue to rise into the future, and that language is coming out with the A1 or came out with the A1 amendment. And so now the bill that's before us, we're just asking for an increase for 2015, and the department will build additional increases that they propose into their future budgets. And perhaps Mike Milhaney from the department could explain that more.
Yeah, Mr. Milhaney.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Mike McKelleny from Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Very close. As explained, we're currently undergoing some new programs within the domiciliaries. And what this would do is, as stated, give about an extra 80 cents per day to the veterans so that they can it'll be more assistive, we believe, in the potential transitioning of some of the veterans. Right now, there's not been an increase since the last increase was 1997, which is $90 a month. And we'd like to increase that to $114 a month for a one-year period. And again, this is to assist them to buy new clothing for job interviews, put a little more fuel in their vehicles if they have them, and that sort of thing.
Mr. McKelleny, does this have to go to the Finance Committee then? Does this have a fiscal impact?
Madam Chair, it doesn't have a fiscal impact because we're going to absorb this cost internally.
Okay. Do you have a fiscal note to that effect? I mean, no fiscal note has been generated.
There was a fiscal note generated, Madam Chair, but the bill was amended in the House, and it really threw the fiscal note out of whack. So there's not been a new fiscal note since the bill has been amended, requested.
Okay. So we'll hope that you're right if we don't send it to Finance. Any more? Would you like to testify, ma'am?
My name is Robin Gaustein. I'm the Acting Deputy Commissioner for Veterans Healthcare for the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs.
What was your last name again?
Gaustad, G-A-U-S-T-A-D. Mm-hmm. And I think Mike has captured the essence. I'm here to answer any questions that maybe he doesn't have the context for.
Okay. Are there any questions from the committee? Anybody in the audience? Yes, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McLeany, the only veterans home is the one in Minneapolis. Is that the one you're talking about, or are you talking about other ones throughout the state?
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, there's two domiciliaries within the veterans homes. There's five veterans homes within the state. One is a 200-bed domiciliary in Hastings, and there's a 50-bed domiciliary on the Minneapolis Veterans Home campus.
What's a domiciliary? Is that like a dormitory?
Madam Chair, I'm going to actually defer to the expert on that, Robin Gaustad, to explain what exactly that is.
A domiciliary for Veterans Healthcare at Hastings in Minneapolis provides board and lodge with a special emphasis on mental health, chemical dependency, and meeting the medical and healthcare needs of veterans as they're moving through the system and needing transitional housing for their care.
Why is it called a domiciliary?
Domiciliary is a term that was that's coined and legally described by the Department of Veteran Affairs on a federal level, and the per diem and the programming is partially defined by the federal government, and so that that's why we use the term domiciliary and talk about those folks as being in a veteran's home.
Okay. Thank you. Interesting. That's something for Scrabble or something. Are there any other, or I play bananagrams. Are there any other questions? Anybody from the audience want to testify? Is there a motion? Senator Johnson. Senator Johnson moves that Senate Bill 2699 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All those as amended. Thank you. Recommended to pass as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Steben, your other bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 2699 is the bill that
no, it's 1776.
Madam Chair and members, Senate File 1776 is the modification to the Executive Branch Advisory Group recommendations. So in 2013, the legislature enacted a new law requiring the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy to review executive branch advisory groups. And so the LCPFP compiled this list of 162 executive branch advisory groups that had been created in statute over the years. And the list was then used as the basis for conducting hearings. The commission, Speaker Thiessen is the chair of the LCPFP. He sent a letter to the heads of the executive branch agencies that work with advisory groups and asked the agencies to come back or to report back on these different criteria, the mission of the group, what their membership list, and whether there's any compensation provided to the members, the budget, the most recent three meeting dates, which turned out to be pretty interesting because some of them hadn't met in a long, long time, and a list of any reports or recommendations that had been issued to that state agency, the legislature, or the governor, and then a link to the website if there was one. So then to review these 160-some groups, the speaker asked some of us on the LCPFP to get together and kind of dive into the details on what the results were. So Senator Newman and I represented the Senate, and Speaker Thiessen and Representative Mary Liz Holberg from the House met several times over the summer and fall and culled through all this information that the agencies had provided. And there were four hearings, public hearings, from August to December on these more formal reviews of these advisory groups. And at each of the hearings, the LCPFP heard from the agencies that were associated with those groups, and then we discussed issues that came up. The LCPFP made these recommendations, including that 37 of the groups should be repealed, that the remaining group should be reviewed biennially by the LCPFP, that the committee should ensure that newly created advisory groups include an explicit expiration date in statute. This is something for us to keep in mind as members as we look to create advisory groups. We should make sure we have them expire at a set date. And there were some other things. There was a number of other recommendations that came forward. So then these recommendations were parsed into different bills that some of you here carried, and those bills went through the committee process. And the bill that's before us now is the individual LCPFP bills coming back together as one, as they were amended as they went through the process. So. And I do have an amendment at some point But let me just run through what bills were included or are included in Senate File 1776. Senator Wicklund's bill, Senate File 1896 from Health and Human Services. And I should just note that all of these bills passed unanimously out of the committees. And Senator Wicklund also had a bill that came through transportation and judiciary related to state government. Senator Hoffman had a bill from Environment Committee. Senator Carlson on transportation. Senator Champion had a provision or had a bill related to public safety. And there's still a little bit of questions there as it relates to public safety. I believe that if this Senate File 1776 passes this committee, Madam Chair, the Finance Division does want to see that it because of a concern that Senator Dibble has about a particular change to the a commission in the Department of Public Safety's jurisdiction. There is a bill, Senator Carlson bill, from that related to Commerce Division. And Senator Bonoff had a bill that passed unanimously out of higher education. I'm happy to go through each individual advisory group if you would like, or maybe we can just discuss concerns or questions that members have and take it from there.
If members have had a chance to look at the overview, I mean, this was a bipartisan commission that looked at the LCPFP that looked at all these. They had a number of meetings over the fall. I attended some of them, and I think it passed out. I wasn't at the meeting where they passed out, but Senator Steben, they had unanimous support, I assume, when they passed out.
I don't remember, but I don't remember. I think so.
It was unanimous, but
I think so.
Yeah. It was approved by the committee. There didn't seem to be, if there was any controversy or any questions, then some of these were dropped, so that the subcommittees that met did kind of carefully look at them and come in with recommendations as to which one should be retained and which one should be discontinued. Any, Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I'm looking at the amendment that is being offered here, too. I'm looking on page 6 about the Student Advisory Council, and they've and I know we're not on the amendment yet, but it's just...
Page 6 of the amendment?
No, I'm looking on page 6 of the bill, because the amendment refers to page 6, the Student Advisory Council on State Higher Education. And I'm just confused as to the reasoning for the way they crossed out the language.
Okay, Senator Steben, do you want to talk about the amendment now?
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, the language that I believe the language that's in the A3 amendment is reflective of the changes that came through the Higher Ed Committee, and as to why that particular, if you're looking at the bill, as to why that particular committee was slated to be eliminated, I think it is. Let me just look at the list here.
Madam Chair, it says on 1.5, it says the Student Advisory Council, this is on the amendment, to the, and it's crossed out Minnesota, to the office, and then it's of higher education, that's crossed off, is established, to the office. Why don't we just say is established rather than, I don't understand how they.
Advisory Council. I think he's just saying, why can't it just say is established? Why does it have to say Student Advisory Council to the office? Because I think that's where the Student Advisory Council belongs, is the Office of Higher Education.
But that's crossed out.
Ms. James?
Madam Chair and members, I will check right now, but I'm bet that the word office is defined for the chapter as the Office of Higher Education.
Is there anything more you want to say about the A3 amendment?
Madam Chair, just that these are the changes that were reflected in the bills as they move forward, and it reflects the committee work, the committees that looked at these individual bills.
Okay. Someone want to move the A3 amendment?
So moved.
Senator Eaton moves the A3 amendment. Any questions? Anybody in the audience want to comment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I also have the A4 amendment.
Okay.
Which
on paper. It's gonna
perhaps
be
council could explain.
Right. It's an oral amendment.
I think it's
amendment.
Just technical.
Madam Chair and members, the A4 amends the bill on page, I don't think I brought it with me, Senator, because I think it's on page 6.
It says page 6, line
page
14.
Thank you. The amendment is on page 6, line 14, before and insert 116C.712.
And, Council, could you please explain why we need to do that? It's technical.
Madam Chair and members, I believe Kirk Kadelka asked for this amendment, if I'm not mixing up completely unrelated.
And he's here. Mr. Kadelka.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. It is just a simple addition. The bill already, right before there, 116C.711, removes part of an advisory committee, and it doesn't pick up the other part that needs to be repealed. If it's being repealed, both parts, both sections of the law need to be repealed. So it is a technical aspect just to complete the job.
Okay, Senator Eaton moves the A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
So, Madam Chair, again, members, this is a result of a lot of work that our individual committees did and the LCPFP did to try to streamline state government, get rid of committees that are advisory groups that are no longer meeting and are still on the statute books. And I think it's the result of some good work, and it had bipartisan support along the way. So I'd ask for your support here in committee.
Are there any questions? Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, will this group continue to, you know, recommend that these advisory groups be sunsetted? Or,
well, Madam Chair, I believe that, if I recall, the LCPFP is encouraged now to continue to look at advisory groups on a biannual basis, so that if there are more working groups or advisory groups that are no longer needed or meeting, that then we'll catch them again in a more regular fashion instead of waiting another 20 years to try to do a bigger sweep of things.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Again, this is kind of new stuff to me here. So if a commission or a group has a sunset date in it,
that's great.
Could they intervene and take it away before the sunset?
No. Madam Chair,
Stephen.
Senator Johnson, when I talked about that it would be that we in the legislature should consider having sunset dates or dates in which advisory groups are set to expire, that's just so that they are no longer in the statute book, so that they will expire and be done. In some cases, we found there were groups that were meeting past their past the date that in which they were supposed to expire, but for a lot of different reasons, and it's as individual as the different ones we're proposing to get rid of, they continued to meet. Either they weren't aware that they had been sunsetted, essentially, or there was an expiration date in statute, and they kept meeting. But more often, I think what we found is that group stop meeting, yet they were still listed in statute as being active groups. And when we contacted the agencies confirmed in many cases that these groups were no longer meeting or weren't serving the role that they were originally set up to serve. And so it was best just to get rid of them.
Thank you.
Are there any more questions? Can I ask about the audience? Anyone in the audience want to testify? All right. And Senator Eaton moves that Senate Bill 1776 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Rest.
Thank you,
Senator Sieben.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I'm bringing you Senate File 2245, and I do have an author's amendment. This is the first stop. I believe it is the A1 amendment.
Senator Eaton moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill proposes that if a local government or jurisdiction decides to have lifeguards at public beaches, not talking about public pools, there's a whole separate set of statutes with regard to that, but if they choose to have lifeguards at a public beach, that the lifeguards have to have minimum qualifications, which are spelled out in Section 2 of the bill. And that is with the amendment, and that is that they, it's in Subdivision 2, that they be certified in first aid and adult, child, and infant cardiopulmonary resuscitation, have Red Cross, American Red Cross lifeguard certification or the equivalent, and be responsible for the supervision and safety of persons at the public swimming beach while on duty. The first section has been eliminated. The bill came to my attention from one of my House members, Representative Freiberg, who was contacted by the mother of a six-year-old drowning victim at Theodoreworth Lake a year and a half ago. There were lifeguards on duty, but it was discovered that there is no standard requirement for people to feel a degree of confidence in if a local government chooses to have lifeguards at a public beach. And once again, there is a whole set of statutes or provisions dealing with the regulation of public pools, but not public beaches connected with a lake. So it's a very straightforward provision, and to honor this young boy's life.
Senator Rest, did I miss it? Did you explain what happened to him? Is this Tony
Kane?
He drowned. Yeah, I assume that, but because the lifeguard wasn't present. Or?
Well, as I said, there were lifeguards present. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people at the beach, mm-hmm. and the bill doesn't come because there weren't lifeguards present. It comes because following the incident, it's just discovered that there are no regulations across the state for local government beaches, local governments that have beaches on lakes to have minimum requirements. And in a sense, we might expect that, mm-hmm. That them to have that, and this just sets in law what I believe is the public expectation. And the bill is named after the little boy at his mother's request. So,
and how old
was
he?
He was six.
It's Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rust, where it says lifeguards, it says if a state agency, does that, will that cover local governments by saying just a state agency?
That was deleted from the bill, Senator Anderson, by the A1 amendment.
What's that?
That section 1 was deleted from the bill by the A1 amendment.
Madam Chair, this is section 2.
Oh,
subdivision
I'm sorry.
Two.
It's also in section 1. I apologize.
It says if a state agency provides for lifeguards. I'm just wondering if does state cover, you're talking local government. I'm just wondering, you're asking for a state agency to provide lifeguards if, but I'm just wondering, does it cover local, because you mentioned local.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, would you point out the page and line you're looking at?
Oh, I'm sorry. Never mind. The whole section then was covered. Subdivision 2 is gone then along with that. I'm sorry.
All of Section 1 is gone. No. It's okay. Just Section 2 that's section left. Two. And part of the reason for that is that there are very few state when we were dealt with that, there is very few, just a couple of state lakes, and they're already taken care of. So this just deals with if a local government chooses to provide lifeguards, the public should have the expectation that they have adequate training, and they probably already do, but it is a clarification of what the public expects.
Senator Hall.
Nothing more complicated than
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Rest, can you give me an explanation, because I'd like to have a friendly amendment here to remove on line 2.5 the word Red Cross and just put in National Lifeguard Certification and then remove or the equivalent. I think that would speak to a national certification we need out there, and there's plenty of them, groups that are out there, YMCA being one of the more prominent ones. I'm not sure it's a great idea to put the name of one particular organization in. Would you be open to that?
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair and Senator Hall, I'm not aware of that. I believe, and perhaps so there is somebody here representing the American Red Cross that can speak to whether in terms of the regulations for public pools, whether it is American Red Cross certification, and I'm trying to mirror that, not make it any broader or less broader or whatever, but just what is required for.
Is there someone here from the Red Cross?
Yeah, there was. Here to go. Yep. And maybe he can answer that question. And I'm looking back now at the memo provided by House Research while he.
Mr. Moore, were you
and
a
maybe,
lifeguard ever?
And maybe Senate Council knows.
Madam Chair, I'm Vic Moore, and I do represent the American Red Cross at the Capitol. And no, I'm not a lifeguard, and I wouldn't want anyone to really depend on
but
my
skills. But I just heard that Ms. Josephson and Ms. Gasper were both lifeguards. Were you
Madam Chair,
certified
I do,
by the American Red
I do
Cross?
Have the,
I,
the I do have the answer to the to Senator Hall's yeah. question. Under the Minnesota Department of Health regulation for public pools, lifeguards must have American Red Cross lifeguard certification and be certified in those other areas. So this is just mirroring that that statute with regard to public pools.
Madam Chair.
So I guess I wouldn't consider that in a sense a friendly amendment.
Okay.
We're not trying to make anything extraordinary here.
Yeah.
Just
and I'm not necessarily either. I just putting one organization in over others. Had the WSI with American Red Cross, and I was also certified with YMCA, and found them both to be really good and pretty similar. Learned a little more from one from the other, and did lifeguarding. But okay, if it's not a friendly amendment, I'll look at something different. Maybe
I'm just trying to standardize it, Madam Chair and Senator Hall, not to make any extraordinary requirement.
Right. Madam Chair, just look at naming an organization. What if the organization went out of business?
you know, it's hard to just put something like, and we understand American Red Cross is huge around the world, but so is YMCA.
Senator Hall, we're looking online at the United States Lifeguard Standards Coalition, and the YMCA is part of the coalition. It's the American Red Cross, the United States Life Saving Association, the YMCA of the USA. Pleased to announce the United States Lifeguard Standards.
And maybe
so we think that, and the American Red Cross is referenced, Ms. Stengel, you said several times in the statute and other places.
Well, in referring to that, using the National Lifeguard Standards might be better than picking out one organization. But it's just my thought.
And
Madam Chair, I'm just
Mr. Moore, I didn't get, I didn't
just
hear
trying
your,
to get it,
yes.
Keep it simple. That's
Mr.
All.
Moore, I didn't hear your testimony because we were laughing about them being lifeguards.
Madam Chair, I actually had not, he wasn't. I had not testified. Senator Rest had saved me from that momentarily. I bring a bit of a bias to the chair. I would very much like to see the American Red Cross identified in the bill.
Senator Hall, are you you're going to withdraw your motion? You're going to pursue?
I'll withdraw the motion right now, but probably end up doing something on the floor.
Okay.
We'll do. Thank you.
Is there any other discussion from anyone? Anyone in the audience want to testify? Okay. Is there a motion? Senator Johnson moves that Senate Bill 2245 is amended, be recommended to pass, sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for hearing me today on Senate File 2700. With me today is Dr. O'Fallon from, he's the president of the Minnesota Humanities Center, Trista Mata Castillo, who is the Veterans Voices Program Officer at the Humanities Center, and Ryan Schmidt, who is also a veteran. He's a fellow at the Humanities Center and is retired, served us honorably in Afghan. So with that, Madam Chair, with passage of 2700, that will designate the month of October has Veterans Voices Month in recognition of the excellent and enduring work that veterans do for our communities. This designation expresses the state's desire to honor, recognize, and celebrate the contributions by veterans. Schools, organizations, and communities are encouraged to hold events and programs that honor veterans and educate students and citizens about veterans' experiences with stories, essays, poetry, and art from men and women who have served. This will also empower the governor to promote and encourage the observance of Veterans Voices Month. Madam Chair, I now turn to Dr. O'Fallon from the Humanities Center.
Dr. O'Fallon.
Madam Chair and members, Senator, thank you very much. Very briefly, the Humanities Center got involved with Veterans Voices and the creation of a program driven by two vets on the board of the Humanities Center, neither of whom can be with us today. Corinda Horton is a Desert Storm combat vet, and Gary Hendrickson, another board member, is a Vietnam-era combat vet as well. The need that drove us here is, to be blunt, quite simply this. We want to create an event and a program that lasts over years that tells a new story of veterans as creative entrepreneurs, as artists, as business leaders, as developers of new enterprises, and that consolidates a need under one broad umbrella, Veterans Voices Month, in which the kind of variety that was just named for you is carried out. And it points to a couple of interesting developments, namely the need to project a very positive story of veterans necessary to the creation of the healthy future of the state of Minnesota. And they are doing that right now. You have in front of you some materials related to the first year of this program. We started with a kickoff event celebrating 25 young men and women veterans under the age of 40 who are making extremely positive contributions to their communities and schools, who are creating businesses, who are involved in education, and so forth. We intend to be a supporter of Veterans Voices Month, and we will collaborate with the many other organizations and days that are involved in celebrating and telling, again, a very positive story of veterans. This program is driven, designed, and created by veterans so they can speak in their own voice from their experience and towards the future that we're collaboratively creating with them. With your permission, I would like to ask our program officer, Trista Masta Castillo, to testify about this bill.
And welcome, Ms. Masta Castillo, and thank you for your service.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you said, I'm Trista Mattis Castillo, and I am the program officer at the Minnesota Humanities Center, and it's great to be here today. Outside of my work in the veterans community, I'm a Boy Scout merit badge counselor. And a few weeks ago, I was working with a group of high school boys who are working towards their Eagle Scout in their citizenship badges. And that includes local citizenship, national citizenship, and international world citizenship. Now, remember, these boys are 14 and 16 years old. So throughout history, they have never known a life not at war. Excuse me. Sorry. When I was talking to the boys about citizenship in the world, they didn't even realize we are a country at war. And yet they've never known a life without it. I think we can all agree that's a problem. That's a real problem, that we have students today that don't realize that there are servicemen and women, 360,000+ veterans in Minnesota, and they have no idea. No one has ever told them. We study World War II history in high schools. It's required. It stops there. There has been a tremendous amount of service that has happened since then, since the One Great War. And this generation is left out in those studies, and our veterans' voices, our own voices, are left out. So that's why this idea came out of the veterans community, and I apologize for getting emotional. But it's really important that we really look at what service means, what war means, and that our students learn about it. So when they become the leaders of the world, maybe we make decisions differently, and we really understand. The veterans community said, you know, why October? Why not November when Veterans Day is? And the thought of that is we need time to prep students. So school starts in September, as you know. October gives an entire month to dedicating to the whole study of what it means to serve, what the service to our country means, what it means to be a veteran, so that on Veterans Day, they can truly celebrate what that means. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And is Mr. Schmidt going to? Mr. Schmidt, and you are a veteran as well?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Yes, I am.
Thank you.
I was in Afghanistan
and
Iraq.
Service.
Thank you. You know, back as far as I can remember in the military, we never went anywhere alone. We're always together. We got in trouble if we were alone. Soldier, where's your battle buddy? Where's your battle buddy? Ranger, where's your battle buddy? Where's your ranger buddy? And if you're out on the battlefield and you're alone, you're having a pretty bad day. And you know who your battle buddies are. I was on active duty. So, I mean, you walk around base, and everybody's in uniform. You know who your brothers and your sisters are. You see them all day long. They're wearing the uniform. It's right there in your face. The difficulty falls is when you come back, and you, like me, when I got medically retired, I came back, and you can't just walk down the street and identify people. They're not wearing the same uniform. You don't know who's your brother and your sisters. And it starts to build this huge gap between civilians and military. And what we're trying to do now is really bridge that gap and bring everybody together. And the place where I found that possible is at the Humanities Center. The Humanities Center is the veterans' battle buddy right now because it's a place, it's on neutral ground. It's not at the VA, it's not at vet centers, it's on a neutral ground where members of the community and the veterans can get together and start to bridge that gap. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, both of you, for your testimony. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I was going to say First Lieutenant Castillo, but sorry. I won't say that.
Thank you, Senator.
Ma'am, I see in here in your brochure it says here that you're going to be partnering with the veterans groups and veterans voices. I'm wondering because there are lots of kids, children that you mentioned don't even know that we're at war. How about, and I know I was in the military too, and we had our buddy system, and if you didn't have your buddy with you, you were in trouble. How about partnering with the public school system?
Mr. O'Fallon.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, absolutely. We will partner with the public school system. And, in fact, part of what is currently underway, and, you know, we had a lot of language in the pieces of paper you saw, but part of what is underway, in fact, is the development of curriculum, again, generated by veterans so that it becomes part of what could happen under the broad umbrella of a month. So that, for example, the 25 men and women that we celebrated in the awards ceremony themselves begin the formation of a kind of speaker and resource bureau. We have better curricular materials, educational materials that can be grounds for discussion and conversation going forward. We intend this to go on. We hope and plan for years. This is a commitment. This isn't a one-off. So we want to engage people, as you heard Officer Tristan McCastile talk about and as you heard Officer Schmidt talk about as well. The need is to bridge gaps, to close understanding, and this is going to be a long-term project, but we're starting with the creation of resource materials and narratives and we'll absolutely cooperate with schools.
Thank you very much. Senator Johnson, question?
And it's really just Senator Anderson's question brought my mind to an event about 10 years ago. My husband is a Korean War veteran, and my granddaughter was in school at Moundsview High School, Irondale, actually, High School, and in Moundsview. And her music teacher, she was a wonderful music teacher. And on Veterans Day, she planned a concert and had each of the children in the choir invite anybody that they knew that was a veteran to come. And they performed the four songs, like, for the Army, it was Over Hill, Over Dale. And so then when they sang that song, they asked all the men from the Army, people from the Army, people from the military or from the Army to stand up. And then they sang Anchors Away, and then that was from the Navy. And then the caissons go rolling along for the Marines, but now I can't think of what's for the Air Force.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, so because I was a Marine, I have to correct you with all due respect. It would be the Marine Corps hymn that they sang for the Marines. Senator Hoffman is in the Air Force Auxiliary, so he probably can answer that for us.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I am tongue-tied. I'm singing it in my head, and I'm just...
Not important. Madam Chair, but I'm...
Off
saying,
we go to the Wild Blue Yonder.
Thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
I'm an Air Force vet. I know the
to
song.
To the rest.
All right.
Thank you. And I'm serious about bringing this up, because, Mr. O'Fallon, you talked about, joining with the schools in terms of making this known. It was a very moving thing for all of the people that were there. And I think the children learned a lot that day.
Senator Anderson, do you want to move the bill?
So moved.
Senator Anderson moves that Senate Bill 2700 be recommended to pass, sent to the Senate floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails.
Madam
thank
Chair.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
good
you
to
very
see you.
Much.
Is Senator Rosen here? Yep, there she is.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members.
Just another unsessioned bill.
80-some pages long, yeah.
Yep.
Senate File 2135, Madam Chair and members, is the Board of Pharmacy General Policy Bill. There are several in this committee that have heard this bill already. It's been to HHS policy, then referred to judiciary, re-referred back to it was supposed to go to finance and now referred here for the rulemaking and powers and duties of the board. So the powers and duties of the board is Section 2, and rulemaking is Section 21. If I could just briefly, Madam Chair, just go through the basic purpose of the bill. As I said, it's the general policy bill for the Board of Pharmacy.
That's fine. Senator Rosen, basic purpose is all, and then we'll just zoom in on our sections.
Wonderful. Thank you. It has four big provisions to it. One is the compounding and manufacturing, which dealt with an issue that happened on some contaminated compounded drug product that came into Minnesota and 60 other or in other states, and there were 60 deaths and 750 cases of fungal infections. So they passed a Drug Quality and Security Act, and it deals with a lot of the compounding manufacturing. Number two is synthetic drugs, the designer drugs, and I know Senator Reinhart has something similar. Speaker Thiessen had the Select Committee on Controlled Substances and on synthetic drugs, and a lot of that comes out of that report. The third is the pharmacist immunization program, and the fourth is disciplinary provisions. With that, Madam Chair, I do have the A2 amendment that if I could have moved. What it does is deletes Subdivision 4, which was, we found out yesterday, had a fiscal note to it because it requires the courts to report back on the orders and actions to the board on specific drug violations, right?
Certain actions that they take against the people that we license.
So with that, I would like to delete that whole subdivision.
Okay, Senator Hall moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, okay, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Hall. With that, I have Dr. Cody Weiberg from the Board of Pharmacy, and he could probably go drill down farther into the powers and duties of the board, and if there's more than I missed besides Section 2 and Section 21, I sure could use some help.
Okay. Dr. Weiberg, if you want to just talk about those sections that are in our jurisdiction.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. The language in both those sections, I think, that are under the jurisdiction of the committee here really come out of the work that the special committee in the House has done on synthetic drugs. In addition, the Attorney General became interested in this issue as well, and she held a hearing up in Duluth. She invited a number of people to testify, and she published a report, basically, that made recommendations for changes for different state agencies and also actually what cities could do as well. One recommendation that came out of the Attorney General's report would be that the Board of Pharmacy be issued cease and desist authority. The Board of Pharmacy, for a very long time, many decades, has had the authority to go into any place in the state from which drugs are dispensed or sold. And if we find that those drugs are what's known as misbranded or adulterated, that is improperly labeled or improperly manufactured or contaminated, we've had the authority for a long time to embargo the drugs, which is to prevent their sale. Using that authority, we have to go to district court to get an order of condemnation. Cease and desist would be a little bit different and complementary to that, in that if we had probable cause to believe that a substance that was being sold was a drug and it was misbranded and adulterated, we would then have the authority to issue a cease and desist order ordering the business to stop selling that product. The business then would have to go to there would be a hearing before an administrative law judge, and after that the business would have to go to court to show why the board was wrong in taking the action it took. The hope is that it would not actually take very many of these actions to get the message across to the businesses that are selling these very dangerous subjects that it just doesn't pay to do so anymore. The rulemaking authority provision is related to this as well. I'd say about 3 or 4 years ago, I was at a town hall meeting up in Representative Jim Abler's district up in Anoka. And one of the people that was there, one of his constituents, was the mother of an individual young man in his early 20s who'd been hospitalized a couple of times. And she asked why something couldn't be done more quickly to get these drugs made illegal. And Representative Abler actually asked me to look into the possibility of expedited rulemaking. And so the legislature did, in fact, pass or give the board authority a couple of sessions ago to engage in the expedited rulemaking process for the purpose of placing drugs into Schedule 1. That authority expires in August of this year, and also there's a provision that requires the legislature to ratify those rules each session. Again, the Attorney General's part of her report was to remove that sunset so that the board would continue to have that authority, and then also to remove the requirement that the rules be ratified. And I think the rationale for that second provision, and I've had some questions about this, well, why wouldn't the legislature be notified? In fact, the legislature would still be notified because there's a general requirement under Chapter 14 and the rules that are promulgated thereunder for any agency that engages in the rulemaking process to notify the chairs and the ranking members of the relevant committees. In addition to that, the Board of Pharmacy has a requirement under a specific subdivision in Section 152.02 to report to the legislature every December specifically on any rulemaking it's engaged in with concerning controlled substances with recommended legislation to conform the schedules found in the statutes with the schedules that the board has created in rule. So basically the legislature would actually be very well notified that this would be occurring, that what the board has done. And I think that's pretty much an explanation.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I'm just curious. I'm assuming that when the law was passed in 2012 with the sunset date of 2014, it was sort of to see how this would work in reality. And how. So then my question is, how has it worked and why, so that we can take away the sunset date? Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, Senator Scalzi, that's actually a very good question, and I don't know if this would alleviate the concerns of certain individuals I'm aware of who think that the board might run amok in this process, but the reality is we haven't used the process yet. We haven't had the resources to do it. We actually started the process in 2012. In order to do the expedited rulemaking, we have to do quite a bit of research to prove five different things are happening before we can schedule the drug. We had just got that research done. We were just about to publish the notices in the state register we needed to publish when we had to deal with the compounding crisis that was killing dozens of people around the country, and we simply weren't able to finish that process.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have an amendment on this issue, if we want to take amendments now for the bill.
Sure.
I'd move the A3 amendment.
Okay. While it's being distributed, would you like to explain it?
Yeah. Members, this is actually regarding the legislative oversight of the scheduling of these substances. And I think there's a couple of factors that I think make this at least somewhat important. The first is that we're greatly expanding the board's ability to classify things as a drug. If you look at the expansion of authority under section
21.
You could go to line 2.9. There's talking about substances that are not necessarily meant for human consumption but have a substantially similar effect to the body if used in conjunction. So we're giving them broader authority to define exactly what is a drug. We're also giving them greater authority to enforce the mechanism through cease and desist. We're giving them civil penalty capabilities. We're giving them the ability to search and inspect facilities. All this is saying is that, as we've done in the past, that the legislature in an even year ought to ratify these decisions. We're not preempting the board from shutting these down in the near term. We are a part-time legislature, and I think there's many members that agree that they ought to have the ability to act in the near term. This is just saying that at some point these decisions ought to come back before the legislature. And I think given the expanded authority that we're granting them, if you look at the last sentence there, 2.14, regardless of whether the substance is marketed for the purposes of human consumption, I don't know what that looks like, and I don't know what that substance could be. I just think it's a good idea that the legislature ought to be able to have some say over the ratification of these items. I've spoken with the author on the amendment. I don't think it's terribly controversial. And frankly, members, we've, I think, passed these pieces of legislation before regarding synthetic drugs by votes of 67-0, 66-1. But this just says that we have to go through that one additional step to ratify the scheduling. That's it.
Would you like to respond?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I will defer to Dr. Weiberg on this. I guess I still question the need for this amendment. I think there are due processes in the bill and in the procedure that take care of the concern of making sure the board runs a tight ship, but I will defer.
Mr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't think the board has any strong objection to the amendment. The only one risk, and this might not be a significant risk, is if the board engages in the rulemaking process, puts something into Schedule 1, and it has to be ratified the next year in the form of legislation, and somehow that legislation gets overlooked or bogged down, then it's not going to be in Schedule 1 anymore. As I mentioned, the board already has to give a report every December to the legislature about any rulemaking it does with controlled substances. So it's not going to create any extra work if this amendment passes. We already have to do that anyway. We'll just have to work a little bit harder during the session if we really think that drug needs to be in there to make sure that it stays in there. So I think the key thing in this piece, I haven't talked to the Attorney General's office, obviously, about this, but I think the key thing in this piece is that the board continues to have that expedited rulemaking authority, and we're not going to object to the legislature having to ratify it.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, I think it is important for the board to stay nimble. In Mankato, just a couple weeks ago, there was a new synthetic drug that killed two people, a teen and a 22-year-old. So we have to make sure that we do not restrict their ability to make the Schedule 1.
Senator Peterson.
Just real briefly, and it's worth pointing out to that last comment that this amendment does not restrict the board's ability to prevent the sale of those drugs by any means. It would still allow the near-term action capability for the Board of Pharmacy to do that. I do also think it's relevant that there is an item on Schedule 1 right now that is controversial and that is not universally agreed upon, medical cannabis or medical marijuana, is a very ongoing debate. So it isn't unprecedented that some of these issues become actual topics of conversation within the legislature. I just think it's important that we maintain some sovereign authority to ratify. So that's it, Madam Chair.
Anyone else want to speak to
Madam
it?
Madam Chair. I just want to know, Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, hearing it all now, are you okay with this, or would you not look at it as a friendly amendment?
There is friendly, and then there's really non-friendly. There's degrees of friendly. I appreciate it. I still think it's somewhat unnecessary. I think that the point that it is going to have to be ratified, and we are, and what happens if we don't get to it, and we do have the stopgap already, is important. So, we're going to have a war on drugs, and anything we can do to help the board stay efficient is important to me. So, and we still have a war on drugs, and we will continue to have a war on drugs.
Anyone else? Not seeing any further discussion. Oh, did you want to speak?
Is this discussion on the amendment?
Yes. No further discussion on the amendment. I will.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask for a roll call just because I don't think members really, since there's no direction from the author and there's a chair who's probably maybe ambivalent. I'm just going to ask for a roll call so we know where we're at on this.
Roll call requested, roll call granted.
Madam Chair, in that case, I think with where the House is going, I would prefer this amendment did not go on.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. Okay. Let's see. Senator Peterson renews his motion to amend Senate File 2135 with the A3 amendment. I'll take the roll call.
Eaton?
No.
Hall?
No.
Anderson?
Yes.
Dahl? Hayden?
No.
Housley?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Peterson?
Yes.
Scalzi?
No.
Thompson?
Yes.
Torres Ray? Wicklund?
No.
Pappas?
Having three yeses and seven noes, the amendment does not pass. So we're back to the original bill, 2135. Is there any? Are there other people who wanted to testify before? Okay. Senator Peterson.
Do we have testifiers? Because we can let them go first.
Okay.
Mine's to the underlying bill.
I think just the one young man here. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Curtis Hanna, K-U-R-T-I-S-H-A-N-N-A. I'm speaking in opposition to the bill today for a number of reasons. I have spoken against this bill twice previously in other committees and actually had some amendments as a result of those comments that I've brought forward. The first comment that I'd like to bring to the committee's attention is the fact that this bill will make every particle in the cosmos defined as a drug, except for substances that are approved for human consumption by the U.S. FDA. I also would like to highlight the fact that the Board of Pharmacy in the section related to the powers of the board specifically are given the power to regulate the manufacture, wholesale, and retail sale of drugs within this state. And by making everything a drug, this, in essence, gives them complete power over pretty much all commerce within the state of Minnesota. This perhaps sounds like hyperbole by saying this, but I do want to point out the fact that this does include flavoring extracts, toilet articles, cosmetics, perfumes, spices, and other commonly used household articles of chemicals for non-medical purposes. It also includes insecticides and common household preparations. And the second section of this change in the term of what a drug is says that even if Minnesota law allows one of these substances, it is still to be determined to be if Minnesota law explicitly legalizes one of these substances, it will still be defined as a drug because a substance will induce an effect similar to a Schedule I or Schedule II controlled substance. And in all honesty, I would be concerned if I was a business owner, especially if that business sold herbal supplements, if it was a hardware store that sold paint or glue, or even a coffee shop that sells coffee. And really, any substance at all could be determined by the board to be an illegal substance. I also want to highlight the fact that there is a provision in law that says that no individual is able to petition the Board of Pharmacy to remove any substance from Schedule 1, and I'd like the committee to just know that anything that gets put into Schedule 1, it is the legislature's duty alone to see that that gets removed, and that the definition of a Schedule 1 drug is that it currently does not have an accepted medical use in the United States. The Board of Pharmacy used to have an annual duty to look at every single substance in the Controlled Substance Act to see if it currently is properly scheduled, and that was removed by the legislature, I believe, 3 years ago. So there is no annual review to see if things are properly there. So giving the Board of Pharmacy the expedited process to add substances to Schedule 1 is very concerning. Also, I would like to say that the fact that the legislature is not even notified is troubling, that substances are added to Schedule 1, let alone the amendment that Senator Peterson offered, saying that the legislature has to also ratify that change. Also, if a business is to appeal a cease and desist order by the Board of Pharmacy, they can only appeal that after the fact. They don't have any sort of ability to try to make this decision ahead of time. And also, the administrative law judge, all of the records, if this bill is to pass, would be sealed from the public. So we wouldn't even know what was going on in the administrative law court related to an appeal from a cease and desist order. So for these reasons, the fact that this will probably be quickly taken to court, challenged because of the vagueness, and probably determined to be void for vagueness, and the fact that this is just simply an arbitrary and capricious and unreasonable use of police power, I believe that this bill is completely unconstitutional, and I hope that you would please vote against it. And
Ms. Chair?
One second. Mr. Hannock, could you identify who you're representing?
I'm just here as a concerned citizen, and I guess I'm here supporting freedom.
Okay. Senator Scalzi.
Ms. Chair, could legal counsel advise us? I mean, I'm not able to follow the testimony of this testifier. Could legal counsel tell us which are the sections that we should be focusing on at this committee meeting?
Madam Chair.
I know the expedited rulemaking, but I'm wondering if there's others.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Scalzi and members, as Senator Rosen mentioned earlier, Section 2 has rulemaking and administrative procedure issues, and then Section 21 on page 51, as you've all been talking about, has this change in the power of the board.
And Madam Chair,
Senator
Mr. Hanna was going off of Senate File 2028, which is Senator Reinhart's bill. So if there was some confusion where he was talking, that's I was confused too until I looked over. So they're very similar, but they are different.
Thank you for that clarification. Did Mr. Weiberg, did you, or Dr. Weiberg, did you care to speak to any of that? Or?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just briefly. I believe I heard Mr. Hanna say that the legislature wouldn't be notified. I've already testified actually to the effect that even without Senator Peterson's amendment passing, the board is actually required in, by two different sections of statutes to notify the legislature whenever it engages in any sort of, well, one section whenever it engages in any sort of rulemaking whatsoever, and a second section that specifically deals with controlled substance scheduling. So the legislature, in fact, would be notified as to what we do. Mr. Hanna has testified that the board cannot remove substances from Schedule 1. I'd say, I'm not quite sure how long ago it was, but several years ago, Mr. Hanna petitioned the Board of Pharmacy twice when it did have the authority to remove substances from Schedule 1, to remove marijuana from Schedule 1. And in part of the explanation, I won't go through the whole explanation that we gave to Mr. Hanna when the board denied those petitions, but part of the explanation was that that would take a step towards making marijuana legal in the state. And while marijuana would still be a federal Schedule I drug, and it would still be a felony under federal law to possess and sell marijuana. So part of the argument back to Mr. Hanna was, if any entity in state government would put the state government of Minnesota at odds with federal law, it ought to be the legislature and not the Board of Pharmacy.
Understood. Any further discussion? Senator Peterson.
Yeah, I'm looking at line 11.19. It's clause 11, actually, in the powers and duties of the Board of Pharmacy. It's to enter and inspect any business to which issues license or registration. Is that an expansion of the board's authority? I see it's obviously an expansion of the statute. It's underlined. But and if that's the case, can you just talk about the genesis of that language?
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, actually that is not an expansion. The board has, for a very long time, had authority to enter and inspect any, actually more than just any facility we license. The way the language reads is we have the authority to enter in to inspect any facility from which drugs are sold, vended. There's a whole series of languages that mean this, or words that mean the same thing. But basically, any place within the state where drugs are held and then sold, the board can go in, and then the board can take samples if it pays for the samples. And if I might, that actually brings up another response, I think, to Mr. Hanna. The language about changing the definition of drug would not allow the Board of Pharmacy to regulate anything from coffee to paint and glue. It basically says it has to be a substance not approved for human use that, when introduced into the body, produces an effect that's similar to a drug that's already in Schedule I or Schedule II. So we're talking about actually not the universe of all known substances, but a very narrow range of substances that will actually mimic the pharmacological effects of the drugs that are listed and substances that are listed in Schedule I and Schedule II. Certainly, we can't do coffee, and we have no desire whatsoever to start inspecting the hundreds of Starbucks in the state. We don't have the staff to do that.
Sounds like fun. Thank you, Dr. Weiberg. Senator Peterson.
Yeah, I'm just – so I guess my question was, why is that language in there if it's already an authority? I mean, I can see what you're referring to. I see that on line 10.4. Usually you don't just add language to the statute if you already can do it. So I guess I'm wondering why line 11.19 exists in the bill.
Let's see. Mr. Weiberg? Dr. Weiberg?
Yeah. Actually, this, you know, this is language that I worked out with the Attorney General's office. I'm, you know, quite frankly, I'm not quite sure why it is actually in there, because we already have authority, existing authority. It's actually on the previous page of the bill on line 10.4, because certainly any of the businesses that we issue a license to are, almost any of the businesses are going to have drugs, medicines, and medical gases. You know what? I do think of one thing. We are starting to license as pharmacies. Now I do remember why this is in here. I'm sorry. We're starting to license businesses as what we call limited services pharmacies, but they don't actually have drugs on hand. And the previous language allows us to go where drugs are stored. And so these facilities, for example, all they do is people might mail their prescriptions to this limited service pharmacy. They might do data entry of the prescription. The pharmacist working there verifies that everything was accurately entered into the system from the prescription. Then the prescription's electronically sent to their mail order pharmacy down in Arizona. That's why we put that in there, to make it crystal clear that the businesses that we actually do license that are now starting not to actually have drugs in them, we can go into them as well. That's what it was.
Senator Peterson.
Okay. And then thank you for that. I appreciate it. Looking at line page 17.10 and then referring to page 22, line 8, we've talked a lot about the drugs and the scheduling and all of this. This is more related to the clause 14, which allows the Board of Pharmacy to require mental and physical examinations of individuals who are licensed, and that those licensed individuals are presumed to have consented to these examinations by the fact that they're licensed, mm-hmm. And that all of the testimony really provided by these examinations cannot be challenged in court. Could you just speak to the I understand sort of the impetus behind what you're trying to do to sort of shut down what you deem to be hazardous drug operations. What is the impetus for this, what seems to be, a great expansion of the authority to get into, in sort of invasive ways almost, mm-hmm. individuals who are licensed in your field?
Madam Chair,
Senator. I just want to be sure. I know we have a lot to do, and I appreciate Senator Peterson's thorough reading of the bill. I just wanted to be sure, Madam Chair, and Senator Rosen, Senator Peterson, I don't know all the committees that this went through, but is this, and I know we have this, I wish Senator Pappas was here, we have this conversation about bills that are in front of us in the jurisdiction of the committee. So maybe counsel can help us understand if the line of questioning that Senator Peterson is going down is the part of the bill in which our committee has jurisdiction. I just think that that's important, and I'm not sure, but I just know that these bills travel a lot to a lot of different committees that do have jurisdiction, and I'm just trying to figure out if we are on track here today.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, and members, the issue of whether a board or agency has its duties changed is something that is within the jurisdiction of this committee. So even though I hadn't identified this section as one in your jurisdiction, Senator Peterson's question is within, raises questions that are
just
in the jurisdiction.
Thank you. Thank you.
Would you like to respond, Doctor?
Absolutely. Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, the purpose for writing the disciplinary section is not at all related to what we've been talking about up until now. This was actually also the recommendation of the Attorney General's office, but in this case, it's the legal counsel for the board. Our current disciplinary language, this is actually the one piece of our bill that actually does fit in with the unsession. The disciplinary language of our bill, much of it dates back to the 1940s. And so on the advice of our legal counsel, our assistant AG, we use the disciplinary language found in the Medical Practice Act as our model. So this language is actually, and I've done a little bit of research because this question came up in the House as well, this exact language is found in the practice acts of, I think it's close to a dozen health licensing boards and the Department of Health. So this is new language for the Board of Pharmacy, but it is not at all new language for the health licensing boards. I can actually give you, we do have examples of cases where we have investigated complaints and we're statutorily obligated to investigate any jurisdictional complaints, but where we have investigated complaints made by both patients and employers about pharmacists that have shown signs of significant mental illness. And in some instances, and I know this actually more from the fact that early in my career I worked as a clinical pharmacist in the state psychiatric hospital system, sometimes people who do have significant mental illness are not particularly cooperative. The alternative actually to having them have a mental examination would actually be to suspend their license, which certainly has its own onerous aspects as well. And so this is actually not new language whatsoever. In statute, it is new for us, but this is language that most of the other health licensing boards have had for quite some time.
Senator Rosen, thank to this
you.
Point.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, this was covered thoroughly in the Judiciary Committee. And actually, I did that committee without Dr. Weiberg. So, but he's exactly right. The other health licensing boards have this authority, and then they're required to follow rigorous due process that is actually spelled out in the Administrative Procedure Acts and Rules. So correct. It is tight.
Thank you. Senator Peterson?
Thank you. Just one last follow-up question. I really appreciate it. What is the threshold for there's the immediate mental and physical examination. There's also sort of a background of all existing insurance data, health records, mental health records that can be requested by the Board of Pharmacy. Mm-hmm. What sort of threshold needs to be met in order for you to get to that level of examination of a of an individual that's the subject of your inquiries?
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, we investigate every complaint on a case-by-case basis. We look at a variety of different things. First of all, we look at the credibility of the complainant. We look at, and by that I mean there might be a difference between having several of the person's employees who don't would not otherwise, or fellow employees and managers who wouldn't otherwise seem to have any reason to do something versus a ex-spouse, which we get sometimes. So you look at credibility of who's doing the complaint. We in a case involving mental illness, actually, we have the investigators at the Attorney General's office look at the complaint as well. And the first thing that they would do typically in a case like this would be to interview all the people involved and try to actually get voluntary consent to get any of these records. It would only be if, in fact, there was real credible evidence that there was a significant problem going on and there would be, and we're not getting any cooperation, that you'd start looking at records like this.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move Senate File 2135 as amended.
Are there any more discussion? Seeing none. Senator Hall moves that Senate File 2135 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Thank you, Senator Hall.
So now we have Senator Dietzick, Senate File 1614.
Bill up, I have to leave, but I did want to announce that Senate File 2642 and Senate File 2745, we are not going to have time for those bills today, so we will take them up on Friday morning. The committee meets at 9 o'clock.
Okay, Senator Dietzick.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. The purpose of Senate File 1614 is to require labor peace agreements between infrastructure project developers and the unions that represent workers in the hospitality industry when taxpayer funds are part of the project. The concept of labor peace is not new to the state or the legislature. In the past, when the state made an investment in private development that involved the creation of server jobs or hotel worker jobs, the state made sure that there would not be an economic disruption to project construction. It was done by ensuring that a labor peace agreement was in place as part of the development before going forward with the public subsidy. Labor peace agreements are essentially a contract between property developers or managers and a hospitality union. The negotiated agreement lays out an orderly process for the workers to learn about labor unions and decide if they wish to join. The agreement prevents the union from staging pickets or economic boycotts that can disrupt construction or operation of the development. In return, management agrees to remain neutral in conversations between workers and the union. Labor peace agreements are commonplace in the hospitality industry, and most, if not every, major hotel chain throughout the country and in cities throughout the country have signed agreements put in place for an orderly process for the workers to learn and decide if they want to join the union. Even with the employer's blessing, a majority of employees still have to specifically request representation from the union. Many employers and unions utilize labor peace agreements to avoid acrimonious and costly confrontations. In Minnesota, the Twins, the Vikings, the City of St. Paul, the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and a number of hotel projects have labor peace agreements. In 2008, as part of the Mall of America public investment, the legislature included, and Governor Pawlenty signed, a labor peace requirement that facilitated the agreement of the Radisson Blue property. That property developed on time, on schedule, and on budget. In 2008, the Republican National Convention signed a general short-term labor peace agreement with local labor for RNC events held at facilities throughout the metro. Cities and states across the country have found these agreements to be useful to ensure that plans for development go forward in an orderly fashion. In the past, the legislature has required labor peace agreements as part of individual projects. This law requires it in all qualified projects where the state has a proprietary interest in the project. It's being proactive instead of reactive. It sets an expectation for protecting taxpayer interests. Thank you, members, for your time and consideration. I have a delete all amendment to get the bill in the shape. So if we could pass that out. I have with me here Wade Lundberg from Unite here to answer questions. And then I believe Mr. Quillith and Mr. McElroy might also want to testify. And there might be others
out
there
too.
Would you
like to identify yourself for the record?
Sure, thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, Wade Lundberg, I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of Unite Here, Local 17, and also the Secretary-Treasurer of the Minnesota State Council of Unite Here Unions. And I'm giving a set of readers a test run here today, so you'll forgive me. As Senator Dietzick mentioned, labor unions do have a right to use economic disruption as a way to answer uncooperative management as workers consider joining a union, but it's not our preferred way of doing business. We would prefer to simply have an agreement up front with management that clearly defines what each party can and cannot do in a potential campaign to organize. In these agreements, the union gives up their right to picket and economic boycotts, and in return, the employer agrees to remain neutral in the process of individual workers choosing whether or not to join a union. The benefit to the state, the developer, and to the union of these agreements is an orderly process. The state has the certainty of knowing that there won't be pickets or economic boycotts that can affect the opening or the operations of a public project. To the union, we negotiate appropriate access to workers and the ability to ask whether or not they'd like to join the union without fear or harassment. The operator is guaranteed a smoothly run operation when and if an organizing campaign occurs. It should be noted that union organizing campaigns don't always work. In the Volkswagen plant in Tennessee recently, the company took a neutral position to unionize workers. After the UAW spoke to workers, they had an election and ultimately chose not to join the UAW. Likewise, nothing in this legislation forces workers to join a union. It simply creates a neutral process for workers to make an informed decision. Even though public dollars, in some cases many millions of dollars, are spent on hospitality projects in Minnesota, there is no automatic right for the public or for unions to speak with workers. This process creates that platform for all parties to operate in an agreed-upon way. My union, Unite Here, works hard to advocate for working people to ensure that their work is respected, their wages are fair, and that they have good health and retirement benefits. Some would suggest that along with our employers, we help create and maintain much-needed standards in our vast industry. We are in the business of moving workers forward in this industry. We also are in the business of moving working people's families forward in the larger community. We believe that having good policies like this contribute to just that. And I would ask for your support on Senator Dietzick's bill.
Thank you. Is there any questions for Mr. Lundberg? We should probably move your amendment before we go any further. Senator Torres Ray moves that the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
Amendment carried. Other testifiers? Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Lodging Association. And I'm here on behalf of our members to express concerns about the details. I appreciate having a copy of the delete all in advance. That was helpful. Thank you. We're not opposed to labor peace agreements. As Senator and Wade had indicated, they have been used in the past. We have three specific concerns about this bill. We worry about the fact of it applying only in cities of the first class, which we believe creates some may create unintended consequences. Large hotel projects compete for capital with real estate investment trusts from around the country and the world, from large management companies, from brand owners, and things that perceive to make developing hotels more complicated, make it harder to compete for that capital. We're also not opposed to voluntary requirements, but we think making it mandatory and singling out hotels and hospitality businesses is a concerning public policy. We have a particular objection to the subdivision requiring binding arbitration. It puts hotel developers, real estate investment trusts, and brands in a very difficult position, in a sense, to negotiate without much leverage or at times negotiate against themselves if they know the outcome finally is that they're facing binding arbitration. We're also very concerned about the language that includes restaurants, including sublessees, that may be part of a hospitality project to have the labor peace agreement carried down to them and ask them to be neutral on a potential organization. So in a hotel that might be 300,000 or 400,000 square feet and represent an investment of tens of millions of dollars, a franchisee that wanted to put a Starbucks or a Caribou or a Jamba Juice in the lobby of that property would be subject to the same complexity that the owner of the entire project is subject to, and we think that's problematic. We're also concerned about the language that says a restaurant or food service operation that's integral to the project. Does integral mean in the parking lot nearby or in the as a part of the parking garage that was also built at the time the hotel was built? Their lack of definition about what goes into the $2 million is also a concern. Whether that's the present cash value of a longer investment, whether that's the stream of value in a bond issue that might include interest over 20 or 30 years, that $2 million number is, I think, subject to controversy and concern over time. I do want to comment the delete everything is a big improvement over the bill as it was originally introduced, and we appreciate clarifying that it doesn't apply in entire counties, that it doesn't apply to very small projects, that it focuses more, and I know what the senator and the unions are concerned about, which are very big projects, some of which have been subject to individually negotiated agreements, but there may be some where that's not the case, and we're concerned about the confusion this may cause. So, Madam Chair, I want to make clear that the hotel industry wants to work with the HERA, and we hope to get better at that over time. But we have grave concerns about this mandate and about the details of this bill, particularly where it applies, mandatory arbitration, and what a restaurant that's an integral part of a project might mean.
Thank you, Mr. McElroy. Are there any questions from the committee for Mr. McElroy? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the amendment, it says hospitality workers, full-time or regular part-time employees of hotels and integral food and beverages. When you mean regular part-time, what's the definition of a regular part-time? Senator?
Regular part-time and Dan, you might correct me, but regular part-time for us in our industry generally means under 30 hours, but you're regularly scheduled. So you may not be qualifying for said insurance plan at a company or...
A recurring relationship for part-time hours, weekly or monthly, I think we understand what it means, and there probably is a definition under Fair Labor Standards that we could... That part of the bill we're not concerned about. That won't cause misunderstandings.
Okay. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McElroy, do you think that this would give caution to some industry coming into the areas that this would represent, first-class cities, where they would want to build outside of those, or... that this would make them want to come to those first-class areas?
Mr. McElroy.
Madam Chair and Senator Hall, it will depend on how attractive a project is. If we continue to have high occupancy and high rates, this may be a complexity that a hotel investment company would be willing to deal with. If the market becomes less attractive in the future, it may be more challenging. For a project adjacent to the new professional football stadium, it may have a different answer than for a project 5 miles from there that's intended to serve a more general audience. Mm-hmm. And so for some projects, I think it will be a real problem. For others, we'll find a way to deal with it. And the projects adjacent to the new football stadium are going to be need a development agreement with the city of Minneapolis, which already has a provision like this. And so I am more concerned about a redevelopment in the Lumber Exchange building that may or may not fit this, but it's a very tricky project to do, but it's exciting because of using an old building, or a project that might be built as part of the interchange transit hub on Third Avenue North. Those are more fragile, and this could keep those from penciling out.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Do you have any more testifiers?
I don't believe so.
Would like to move. Okay. Okay. Senator Torres Ray moves that Senate File 1614, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
No, I think it's re-referred back to taxes.
And referred back to taxes. You're right. Everybody understand the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay.
No.
No.
Motion passes. Senator Johnson. Don't lose my mind. I thought for some reason taxes didn't need it anymore.
Somebody left there.
Johnson is coming. Senator Johnson, Senate File 2312.
Madam Chair, members, Senate 2312 is one of the unsession proposals. It's from the Department of Administration, and even though the bill looks pretty substantial, it's really a lot of rearranging, reorganizing, clarifying, and doing the things that we all like to have happen to our statutes. There are also a good number of repealers, things that are outdated and not being used anymore. Mr. Yoakum from the legislative liaison from the Department of Administration is here to talk to you about this bill. Thank you.
Senator Johnson, would you like to move your author's amendment first?
Yes, please. I would move to... I don't have a copy of the amendment.
Oh, the A1.
A1 amendment, Madam Chair.
Does everyone else have a copy?
Mm-mm.
It's coming. I'll give people opportunity to see it. All right. Any discussion on the amendment? It's an author's amendment. Is this your first stop?
Yes, it is. And, okay. Madam Chair, I will tell you that it takes out Section 1 of the bill, which has been somewhat controversial.
Okay.
And actually, it's and then on page 13, delete subdivision 20, which was another somewhat controversial bill or initiative. So we're taking those two items out of here and then renumbering.
Okay.
Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Senator Johnson, then, for Section 1, where you say you're deleting that section, are you just undoing the deleted language, and so it's going back to the way it was before?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Senator Johnson moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the order in the shape she'd like. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
And, Madam Chair, this puts the bill in the same shape as the House bill is.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kurt Yoakum, legislative liaison with Minnesota Department of Administration. Given the late hour, I'll attempt to be brief here. As Senator Johnson noted, this is what this bill represents are unsessioned proposals that the Department of Administration put forward. And prior to session starting, chairs and ranking members from both the House and the Senate sat down to review these along with staff. And my apologies after the fact, because those are definitely hours none of you will ever get back. But we do appreciate the amount of time that everybody put in scrubbing this. And I hope that the bill that's before you today does represent the advice that we got from both House and Senate Democrats and Republicans as to what was appropriate and inappropriate to be in this legislation. As we went forward with the unsessioned process put forward by Governor Dayton, we focused on two things. One is, what are the statutes that are still relevant to the services that we provide our customers? Primarily as a central service agency, our customers are other state agencies, but also local governments and nonprofits and the public. But then also to make sure that our statutes are coherent and accessible. Just for way of a little bit of background, the primary authorizing statutes for the Minnesota Department of Administration are 16B and 16C. 16B is our general authorizing statute that outlines our duties, our responsibilities, our various divisions, and 16C is the state's procurement code, providing the oversight, our oversight responsibilities and authorizations for the enterprise contract oversights and purchasing oversight. The problem is over the years, both 16B and 16C, the language between the two have become intermixed. Some of our authorizing language that probably more appropriately belongs in 16B has been put in 16C, and procurement language has been placed in 16B where it belongs in 16C. In addition to that, quite frankly, compared to a lot of other statutes in the Minnesota statute books, 16C is not well laid out. It's doesn't have headers. It's not organized logically, and quite frankly, unless you know what you're looking for and exactly where it is in 16C, it is very difficult to find. And so that is the bulk of what our bill is about today, is trying to clarify, bringing some logic and consistency and some coherence to those two statutes, moving all the non-procurement language out of 16C and putting that into 16B, and then making 16C a pure procurement statute, making sure our language is in there, and logically organizing it. So I realize you have a pretty weighty tome in front of you with 32 pages, but the bulk of that is really the logistics of separating and moving that language apart, and then making sure that we appropriately have the correct definition, statutory authority going throughout the statutes in both 16B and 16C, so it is coherent and a little easier to understand. And I'd like to emphasize why we actually think that's important and why it's worthwhile to take your time today. The state of Minnesota contracts with 25,000 different vendors from the state of Minnesota and throughout the country. In addition to that, every state agency uses 16C for contracting and purchasing. In addition to that, more than 1,500 local subdivisions and nonprofits access our state contracts. We want to have a set of statutes that's actually accessible and understandable for those folks to use. And so that is the bulk of what you're seeing here today. But in addition, that we also looked at for all of our services in statute, what are the services that we still provide? What are the services that we provide the other state agencies, and which ones are still relevant? And basically, in the first two pages of the bill in particular, if you, you'll see in the repealer section, but also some of the language on page one and two. Those are services, what we're really doing in that area, those are repealing services that we, or striking out services that we don't necessarily deliver anymore. The state of Minnesota doesn't offer telegraph services to its other agencies. We don't provide micrographic services. It's outdated. We don't have a central storehouse anymore, and so we have deleted that language and the appropriate revolving fund language that would be associated with those. And then the biggest chunk is there was what was once known as the Non-Government Pharmaceutical Contracting Alliance, something that was passed in the 90s that really wasn't successful, and subsequent state and federal policies have really negated the need for those. And so those are the changes that you see in 16B and in the repealer section that are highlighted in there. And then I would say in the final, the third kind of theme of the bill that you'd probably see our most substantive changes is within 16C, and it's professional technical contracting, which has long been confusing for other agencies and kind of cumbersome for sometimes for our staff even to deal with, who deal with it day in and day out. If you go back to 2003, the Office of Legislative Auditor did a report on professional technical contracting in Minnesota and had made several suggestions, quite a few suggestions actually, and over the years we've carried out most of them. But two things that are still out there that that we're hoping to address in this bill is changing the threshold, some of the thresholds in for PT contracting, on which we do the upfront reviews as opposed to the agencies who have authorities to do professional technical contracting, and make those more inconsistent with goods and services. Right now, when one does a solicitation in goods and services, when they have to do formal solicitations and advertising, that's done at a $25,000 threshold. But for professional technical contracts, that's done at $5,000. And it's been that way for, well before the legislative auditor report. And they had suggested that's one of the things that we change. And in addition to that, also change that we, at what point does the Department of Administration exercise its oversight authority in the contracting process? Right now, especially in professional technical contracts, we look at all the solicitations, all the preparation certifications for professional technical contracts at a $5,000 threshold. In 2003, 11 years ago, the OLA said we should up that to at least $20,000. And that, for us doing reviews of solicitations prior to them going out, OLA said, you're spending too much time on low dollar value on solicitations. Delegate those to the well-performing agencies that are capable of carrying that out, and then concentrate on, for proper risk management, concentrate on higher level contracts. And we picked that at $25,000 and over, which is consistent with the other sections of contracting in 16C. On the flip side of that, though, is after the process, after there's contracts already signed, or after contracts are ready to be signed, we at the department will still be approving every contract and still signing every contract, so there is still that safety valve. But on the front end, on the certification, we would still, per the OLA's recommendation, still be doing an auditing process to make sure that that process is valid and going forward. And then on top of that, in the PT contracting side, what we propose in this legislation is just bringing consistency throughout the statute for professional technical contracts. In the front end, we have certain things such as service certification requirements for contracts over $5,000. We're just saying let's make those applicable to all dollar thresholds, so state agencies, when they're doing that, are applying the service certification process to all professional contract levels. So it's not a bifurcated process of a $5,000 dividing line, just trying to bring some consistency. So in any event, that's 32 pages in a nutshell right there, but if you look at the very back of the bill that's in front of you, all the repealers that are in the bill are spelled out. I outlined the ones from 16B. In 16C, nearly most of those repealers are actually incorporated back into the language, whether it's in definitions or somewhere else. The reviser wrote it in such a way, showing those as repealers, but a lot of the language is actually placed back into statute in there. So in any event, that's a quick overview, I realize, but wanted to be respectful of your time and give you an opportunity for questions on the process. Thank you.
Any more questions, discussion? Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, in your deletal amendment, Senator Johnson, on 1.12, it says page 31, delete section 1. So I'm guessing that you're reinstating the language that has been stricken. And I'm wondering if Mr. Yoakum could tell me what 16C.16 subdivision 3 relates to. Because it talks about small businesses, and I'm just wondering what.
Actually, what this section is doing is this is a technical amendment on 31. So the reviser had looked at with earlier drafts of the bill, we had looked at about possibly making changes under best value contracting. We never actually made those changes, but in the earlier drafts, there were some placeholders put in. And what's put here in this section 1 on page 31, that was actually a conforming amendment that the reviser said there's a cross-reference to that statute in under legislative contracts where they reference back to that. We never actually made that change, and that's why we're deleting this section, because this cross-reference should not be in here. So that's what we're doing here. So what this is, by deleting that, we're recognizing that we're not making any change in law in reference to that. If that makes sense to you.
Any more discussion? Anyone from the audience want to testify? Then Senator Johnson. Want me to move? That Senate Bill 2312 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Okay, Senator Johnson, 2659.
I do have an amendment for the bill, Madam Chair.
Okay, let's pass out the amendment.
A1 amendment.
All right, Senator Anderson, Senator Johnson moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. It just changes the dates because this was right. That's all it does.
Madam Chair, some of you may not know that I am appointed from the Senate to the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And therefore, I'm involved in the issues of the Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And this bill comes as a recommendation from the council. Have with me especially Sia Herr, who is the executive director of the council, and also a representative from the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. Sure. And then another citizen who is here to testify. And I would ask Sia to explain.
Ms. Herr, welcome.
Ms. Herr, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to come before you today. And Senator Johnson, thank you for carrying this bill. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sia Herr, and I am the executive director of the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. I am here before you today to speak on behalf of Senate File 2659. This is a bill that asks for dedicated funds to pursue research into an area that in a number of our immigrant communities has been ignored by a mainstream community for fear of intruding into the cultures of immigrant groups or not acknowledged by immigrant groups ourselves because of a fear of showing our dirty laundry in public. I am speaking of domestic abuse and neglect that may cross the line to human trafficking, a form of abuse and neglect that serves to create cultures of dependency. But before I go any further, let me give you a little bit of background. The Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans represents a very diverse community of Minnesotans. We are charged with representing ethnic groups from over 40 Asian and Pacific Islander nations. Some of us are immigrants. Some of us are refugees. Some of us are the children and grandchildren of immigrants and refugees. Some of us are doing extremely well economically and educationally, to the extent that the most successful of us are doing better than most Minnesotans and Americans overall. Some of us are, however, are not doing so well. Many of us are among the poorest in our state and country. This bill, Senate File 2659, asks the legislature to mandate and provide funding for a study to shed light and provide clarity on practices of domestic abuse and other forms of exploitation that are supported by power differentials between husbands and wives, men and women, that make reporting even more difficult for abused individuals from this community. For example, here in Minnesota, our largest Asian Minnesotan community is the Hmong. In the Hmong community, a different but a steadily growing problem is what is known as international abusive marriage or marriages. In these instances, Hmong American men, oftentimes 20 to 40 years older, marry younger, sometimes underage, girls from Southeast Asia. International abusive marriages increase sexual and domestic violence, as well as neglect and exploitation of women and children here in the United States. This legislative mandate would empower DHS to contract with an appropriate research group to create interview teams, provide field researchers, and follow the stories where they go. Fundamentally, we are seeking data that will allow the actions of the next legislative session to be driven by facts when it comes to the issue of domestic violence and other dangerous situations as far as Asian Pacific Islander women are concerned. This legislative mandate should empower both the victims and the silent witnesses who feel unable to break the cycles of abuse because of fear of retaliation, marginalization, or other internal community pressures. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon. I have two members of our community here with me as well, and they're going to be sharing some stories. So at this point in time, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I will turn it over to Dave Pinto, who is the Assistant Ramsey County Attorney.
Welcome, Mr. Pinto, and congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, Dave Pinto, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney. I'm here on behalf of Ramsey County Attorney John Choi. I specialize in crimes of domestic and sexual violence for the County Attorney's Office. These crimes are very prevalent in the Asian Pacific Minnesotan community. I've handled many crimes of domestic violence in that community. And then certainly I'm aware of many instances of sex trafficking, sexual exploitation in that community as well. I should also note on a personal note that prior to being at the county attorney's office when I was in private practice, I did some legal work pro bono for the Association for the Advancement of Hmong Women, which is a group which has really done a lot of work for this community as well. So these crimes are very prevalent in this community, but my understanding is that we don't know how prevalent they are. We know these crimes are certainly underreported in all communities, but there's reason to believe that they are particularly underreported in the Asian Pacific Minnesotan community for reasons having to do with shame, with various cultural factors regarding keeping these sorts of things within families and other factors. One particular case that I handled involved a couple that was in their late 40s by the time the police became involved, and it emerged that the husband had been being quite physically abusive to the wife for a couple decades at that point, just something that had been kept very much within the family and not intervention in the community and in society. Again, we know that these crimes are underreported in all communities, but there's reason to believe they're particularly underreported in this community. The problem is we just don't know how underreported they are. We don't have the data, and we don't have a sense as to what to do precisely to address that. And for these reasons, the County Attorney's Office, Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and County Attorney Choi are supportive of the committee supporting this task force. Thank you.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Johnson, this may be more to you or Ms. Herr. I just had a question, and maybe there's a simple explanation, but why are we working with just Asian Pacific versus Asian? Is there a difference that we're not concerned about the bigger Asian group, or is it just the name of the group that is put together?
Ms. Herr.
Senator Hall.
Senator Johnson.
I think Ms. Herr would be the better one to answer that question. I could give you the right answer, but I'd rather be sure.
Ms. Herr.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Hall, thank you for that question. This is a great opportunity for me to do a little bit of education about what the council does and who it represents. Now, when we say Asian Pacific Minnesotans, we are talking about individuals and groups from countries east of and including Afghanistan, Pakistan. So we wrap around to all of the Asian countries such as Japan, Indonesia, Thailand, and then we go all the way to the Pacific Islander nations as well, which is why it's Asian Pacific and not just Asian. So we are actually that Asian Pacific term is very, very broad and very inclusive. We represent individuals and groups from over 42 countries, and so you can well imagine how broad that is. It isn't by any means focused on just a few groups.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Hall.
And Ms. Herr, are those groups more vulnerable or their culture is a little bit different than the broader Asian group, Asia groups? Possibly, anyway.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, I guess I'm not exactly sure what you mean by the broader Asian group. I am saying in my previous answer that we represent quite a broad group already, and so when we say Asian Pacific women, we are talking about a group that includes, you know, all of the Southeast Asian groups, so the Lao, the Hmong, the Vietnamese, the Cambodian, the Thai, and then we're talking about Japanese, Chinese, Filipino. So it's a pretty broad group already. Now, all of these cultures, all of these groups do have some unique characteristics that make them, you know, uniquely their own group, but they also share many social, cultural, and historical variables that make them, you know, that help us to understand within a political realm why they fall under Asian Pacific as a description for the entire group.
Thank you.
So, any other questions for testifiers? Did you have other testifiers? I'm sorry.
Yes, we'd like to have, I don't have anyone here.
Mao Tao.
Express her experience with this issue.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I will do. I will translate for our guest speaker here. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to share my story with you today. Thank you so much. Again, Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for this opportunity to share my life story with you. It isn't often that a woman such as myself would have an opportunity to do something like this. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I will do my very best to give you a brief but substantive enough story of how I came to be where I am today, what happened between my husband and me. Now, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My story will start with the fact that for 22 years I was married to a man, and our marriage was fine up until 2009 when he discovered that he could begin partnerships with some of the young girls in Laos, and that was when our lives started to fall apart. Prior to the point of my story that I would really like to share with you was several incidences in which we called upon the relatives of my husband and the extended clan system to come into our relationship and to help us try to put together the relationship or try to save the marriage from disintegrating altogether. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am a mother of six. I have four girls and two boys. And it's very unfortunate that I have to share this story with you. But again, my husband and I were relatively happy until he realized that he could have a new wife. Once he realized that, our marriage started going downhill. Our relatives were calling to try to keep our marriage together, but that did not work. I gave him the option of dividing our assets so that he could go his own way and I could go my own way, to which he refused the option. So one day we became angry with one another, and as we were arguing, he ran over me with one of our cars. I was in the hospital for several days, and you know, if it wasn't meant to be, I probably would not be here before you today. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I apologize, but sharing my story with you brings tears to me all over again because it was a very sad period in my life. I am just fortunate that I had the opportunity to overcome that situation and to be here before all of you to share my story with you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I have said earlier, I have seen some very, very dark days that no woman should ever have to see. During that time, an aunt of mine recommended to me that I reach out to an organization by the name of the Association for the Advancement of Hmong Women. It was in developing that relationship that I, together with that, with the members of that organization, saved my life. Madam Chair, members of the committee, even though it has been several years since I was hit by my husband hit me with the car, I have very strong reminders of what happened to me. My entire right side body is still reminding me that I once had that very bad accident, and so part of my right side is numb often. And right now, if I touch the right side of my face, I can't really feel it. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my husband has since remarried and brought over his very young wife from Laos. Under some pretenses that I don't want to go into details with you about today, but it's important for me to share with you that when he left, he took all of our assets but left me all of the 6 kids. And today, you know, in spite of all of the challenges that we are experiencing, I am just so thankful to be alive. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as a mother of 6, I am urging you to support this bill so that even though there are those who, like me, have lived through some very dark days, that we do not become part of the norm and that those that we can help will be helped. I don't suffer alone. In my suffering, there are also 6 children involved, and I am just the tip of the iceberg.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lee. I really appreciate you coming here today and telling us your story, and I'm really sorry about your troubles. And I hope that you're very brave to be here, and I hope that we'll have some good outcomes for you in your community.
Madam Chair, can Sia translate to her?
Senator Pappas,
Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am an orphan in a community that values families, and so my life was already very difficult. And this is just an addition to that.
Thank you. Ms. Herr, have you had conversations with the Department of Human Services about this task force? Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, I have. Let me just take a minute to tell you the story of how this bill came to be. I became executive director at the council March of 2013 last year, and one of the first things that I did upon arriving at the council was I had a round of visits with the executive directors of some of the largest API organizations, and it was then that I stumbled upon the Organization for the Advancement of Hmong Women. And I went, they invited me to go and visit them quite urgently, so I scheduled for a time and went and met with a group of about 40 women, very much like Mrs. Lee here. And actually I spent 3 hours with them just hearing their stories about the needs that are on the ground and how for more than a decade women like Miss Lee have been crying silently or have been crying quite loud, but that the sounds of their crying have not gone beyond the community. And so I came back from that round of visits with the executive directors, you know, thinking I'm going to do some, the council is going to do something about this. But then I, the next round of visits was with the commissioners of the various state agencies. And when I sat down with Commissioner Jessen over at DHS, she asked me to share with her some of the highlights of my visits with the nonprofits. I shared them with her, and she picked up on this piece, and she said, I would like you to schedule a follow-up meeting. So I did, and several months later, she and Antonia Wilcoxon, the Department of Human Rights representative who is here, Antonia, Commissioner Jessen, and I went and visited with the group of women, and several of them had the opportunities to share their stories with Commissioner Jessen, who then, after that meeting, called a follow-up meeting between myself and a few of the community leaders. We talked about this, and then Commissioner Jessen turned around, or the Department of Human Services turned around and asked me what I would like to do about this. And they asked me just a few days before I went and sat down with Representative Karen Clark to talk about another bill. And so when I, when Commissioner Representative Clark asked me what I've learned, I shared this with her, and she latched onto it and said, you know, why don't we introduce some legislation on this issue? And it was then that I went back to DHS and said, you know, we don't know. What I know as a Hmong American woman is that there are lots of anecdotal stories. We hear it every day. It is the open secret in the community and in the communities, but we don't have data that I, as a representative of the council, can just bring before you and say, look, here's all the number. Here are all the numbers, which is why I suggested to DHS that and Representative Clark that if we introduce any legislation, that we introduce legislation aimed at right now bringing forth to you some data that we can, you know, that will help to shed light on what the gaps are. So, okay, that's
the story. Thank you. I was in and out, so did Mr. Pinto get a chance to comment?
Mm-hmm.
He did. Okay. Are there any questions then from members of the committee? This bill does go to the Finance Committee, I believe. I think Ms. Lee wanted to, we have another Lee who wanted to comment. Maybe Mr. Pinto could let her.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I wasn't sure if I could make it because I was coming from out of town, but thank you for this opportunity. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, which does legal advocacy and public policy. R and R Family Centers that does shelters, transitional and permanent housing and services, and APAC, the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium of Trusted Professionals and Service Providers and others. I'm a former corporate auditor for Fortune 500 companies, but I almost died, and I'm a survivor of domestic abuse where I was assaulted and there was a gun involved, and again, like I say, I nearly died. So I still suffer from permanent injuries, have trouble speaking, and you think you get over it, but you don't, after many years. Anyway, I know about the unprotected financial exploitation after losing multi-millions of dollars to my abusers. And I know about their impact on family, relatives, parents, children, grandchildren, friends, and colleagues. But the difference is I also know how to make that kind of money back. So I shifted my work to systems change to improve the lives of people and efforts to end violence. I have 50 years of housing in related fields, and I've worked in legal advocacy and policies for 26 years. In doing court work, I also did training, which include training advocates. We had the help of judges, which include Appellate Chief Judge Ed Toussaint. Some of you may know some of these judges. Chief Justice Sandy Keith, Senator Jane Ranum, Senator Anderson, and Senator Dave Knutson, who is now judge. I'll be quick.
Ms. Lee, it's rather late. Could you just address your comments to the bill, please?
Okay. I was speaking in support of this particular bill. However, because of the broad-based experience and the years of experience where we even helped develop the first public shelter, because we're a private shelter, there are many people involved. So when they talk about the task force that's involved, I would request that there not be a limit on the numbers as far as participation in the task force.
There's no limit on numbers.
Pardon?
I don't see any limits.
No, but there is something on the House side which was
okay, well, I think you can testify on the House side.
Right, but
please talk about our bill.
Right, so should it come up, there shouldn't be a limit on the numbers. Okay. It is a multidisciplinary task force and involves many different professions. You've heard from a number of them, and I mentioned a few of the groups that get involved. And so we would ask that you support Senator Johnson's Bill 2659.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify? Any comments from the committee? Then Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and members, and I ask Sia to tell you just very briefly about the support of the council and the community.
Ms. Herr.
Yes. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I am not, I should not bring this up at this point in time, but I'm sure some of you have heard the have read or heard of the report from the Office of Elections.
Mr. You don't really have to bring it up at this time. If nobody in the committee is asking you about it, after our committee deadline, we are going to have a hearing on the councils.
I just, Madam Chair, committees of the member, I just want to share that when I came on board, we did a community survey to help determine our legislative agenda, and domestic violence was one of the issues that was identified there, and the board approved of the legislative agenda. And, of course, in coming here, my vice chair and my chair and the members of the board are clearly on the same page as me, and they know that we are here right now testifying on this bill.
Great. Thank you very much. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, I think you've heard the message, and I think it's very appropriate, and I hope you'll have you will be supporting this bill.
Senator Johnson moves.
I move Senate File 2659 as amended to be passed.
Sent to Finance.
And sent to Finance.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Reinert. We have another pharmacy bill here. Did we get a request from Finance? Soon, because the commissioner just passed.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Oh, I just want to make sure.
Madam Chair, and I believe there
Welcome
is...
Welcome back, Ms. Dr. Weiberg.
I believe there is an amendment, and it's my understanding the committee had a pretty healthy discussion. There are several provisions in this bill which are similar to Senator Rosen's bill, and I think you had a lengthy discussion about that.
I think it's going right from here to Finance, right? So,
which I'm unclear if we're stripping out a the provision that has a an allocation, but okay, we need to go from here to Finance.
All right, Senator Reinert or Dr. Weiberg, would you tell us please why we have two bills, and I hope we're not passing things that are in conflict with each other.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dr. Cody Weiberg, again, the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. Actually, at this bill's last stop, the language was amended to the sections that involve the Board of Pharmacy were amended so that they were the same as what was in Senator Rose's bill, which the committee just heard.
And I understand you wanted to delete Section 9. Is that what you wanted to do?
That's correct.
Okay. Then... Senator Johnson moves to delete Section 9. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. And then the sections that are of interest to this committee would be, must be a reason you're here. Is there rulemaking? Is there a committee? Board of Pharmacy?
Madam Chair, the provisions really.
Additional duties.
Yeah, the provisions related to the Board of Pharmacy are rulemaking in this case and cease and desist order. And, again, they're identical to the bill that was discussed just a little while ago.
All right. So, and then because we took out the money, does that mean it doesn't need to go to Finance or it still goes to Finance?
Madam Chair, I believe there's still another provision. That was my goal in making that amendment.
I'm sorry, what?
That was my goal, Madam Chair, in making that amendment, but I believe there's another provision that Dr. Weiberg knows about that requires us to go to Finance.
That could require Finance. Okay. Then Senator Dahl moves.